I'm Amit Carrasco from Carrasco Wealth Management. Welcome to The Confident Investor. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you for having me, Tom. I've always enjoyed our conversations, and we're in interesting times, that's for sure.
Well, it's again, a phrase that has been overused maybe in the last little bit. But you know, it's kind of crazy to think about, to actually go back and consider how long you and I have actually been speaking for. You were one of my first interviews over at Palisades, and I went back and looked up the prices of gold and silver in the first time we actually spoke. And we can share some charts here this morning on what the prices actually were at that time. So again, going back, you and I started speaking in March of 2020, and it was actually a fairly consequential week. Silver basically went from, you know, $15, $16, $15.50, and dipped all the way down to $11.50. Our first interview was on Tuesday, March 17th, 2020. And again, you know, this shows the volatility at that time, which is interesting to consider volatility now. And then going back as well, you know, gold that week went from $15.75 all the way down to $14.50. So, you know, even going back to the first time that you were on Palisades, gold was in the, I think it was in the about $1,200 range, and silver was around $11. We've seen a lot of, you know, sideways churning since then, you know, volatility back up. And now we're in this moment where there seems to be exuberance actually entering the market. So, you know, Jaime, I think it's always useful to back out and look at this historical move over this time. How do you see that since you and I started speaking?
You know what? I don't pay attention to it. My mantra all along has been forget about the price and worry about allocation. And here we are at $4,000 gold and only 2%, call it 1 to 2% of all Western wealth in the sector. They're not even in yet. So building an allocation, I think, is more important than worrying about the price of the commodity. We are at 4,000. Is it going higher? I believe it's going higher for a number of reasons. You know, and so my strategy, and by the way, we started talking at that point, but I've been investing in the sector since about 2006. But what I've worried more is about the allocation and how I approach my allocation that each client has in the sector. You know, coming into the highs of 2011, which by the way, I think right now we're exactly at the start of 2009, which was an amazing run up. And it doesn't stop till 2011. Well, I let the allocations run, and the bare minimum was 30%, and I let those go. Once we hit that 2019 and 2011 mark, I became a little bit cautious because it was at that point I thought it was overextended, and not because the price of gold, but the signal was it's funny because I was at Bear Creek recently, and we were talking about I was listening to a presentation up in Kirkland Lake, up in Northern Ontario, and they were talking about the IM Gold Mine and the similarities to the IM Gold Mine called Côté Lake. And all of a sudden, it dawned on me that that was Trelawney, the last takeout that we had in that cycle. We did extremely well. We got taken out at roughly about $400 an ounce gold on the ground. Today, that's one of IM Gold's most profitable mine, but what's important about that mine was the takeout where reserves on the ground were worth a lot of money. Reserves on the ground aren't worth anything yet, right? And I think they're going to be worth a lot more money. On top of that, that was the top. So at that point, the first thing we did when gold broke below about 1800, we started cutting back allocations. And then about a year later, when we broke below 1500, then we really cut back the allocation to 5%. And we waited. And we didn't start increasing. I think I was on BNN in 2015 again. And I said, you know, we're going to start increasing the allocations. And we went from 5% to 10%. roughly around when we never broke 1,000 in 2015. So it was 3 years later. And ever since then, all I've been worrying is about increasing the allocation to the sector. And the bare minimum that we have it now is at 30%, any new client coming in the door. What's interesting is how we're managing through the volatility, because I think volatility is important. It's going to be there, especially when now that we're talking about $4,000. Well, a 5 to 10% move is a big move now on a nominal value. But what's important to understand that to go from 4,000 to 5,000, the percentage increase is getting smaller and smaller as we're going exponential. Now, are we going exponential? I think going exponential is sooner or later. It's not an if, it's a when. Mm-hmm. And that's when the credit cycle comes to an end. And I think gold is signaling that, long-term rates are signaling that. Because at the end of the road, and I keep pointing a book called How Money Dies, which is really the monetary history of the Weimar Republic, mm-hmm. which is no different than what's happened in Latin America, no different than what happened in Venezuela in 2019. Like, history is repeating. And sooner or later, central banks are going to lose control of the yield curve. That's inevitable, because the debt bubble, that monster, becomes so big that no matter what amount of money they print, and by the way, be aware that every time that they go into the printing part of the cycle, they're printing more and more money. After COVID, trillions of dollars were issued. How much is going to be issued this time? Way more. To me, I don't particularly care about that, because I'm riding the gold wave. So let's back up and talk about our clients. Like, we have clients that are, you know, we have different pools of investments. The first pool is a conservative pool called the equity income. Yes, go ahead.
Sorry, let me interrupt you. Before we get to how we separate clients at this point, you know, you just mentioned this idea of, you know, gold and silver going exponential. I saw a chart last night that Marin Katusa had posted, and it said that this was the quickest $500 move gold has ever made. Mm-hmm. If we look at, you know, basically any metric, we are overbought in the metals at this point. So do you see caution being warranted and maybe some profit taking needing to happen when we do see a situation like we are at this moment, where gold, you know, if you look at the chart, it is kind of going exponential. Silver is going exponential.
Yes, I do. And I think you have to have some risk mitigating strategies. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what I wanted to describe to you, the different risk mitigating strategies that we have within our portfolios. Because first of all, asset allocation is so important, because 80% of portfolios return will be asset allocation, how you allocate those assets. It's not about writing NVIDIA all the way up, is about what percentage of your portfolio is in NVIDIA and pulling and trimming profits back. Mm-hmm. So here's how this process works. So go back to any client that joined our practice last year, started with a 30% allocation at the very least, the most conservative client within the equity income portfolio, which is a blue chip dividend portfolio.
Let me break you out of that 30%. Is that 30% in physical? Is that 30%?
That is 30% in blue chips, gold and silver producers. The physical component is part of the cash component.
Okay.
If somebody needs cash, and we're going to have a cash or cash equivalents component, money market, there we have the physical component. To me, physical is no different than cash.
Okay.
The speculation, the investment is in the senior producers. You know that Agnico has been part of my book forever, mm-hmm. right? So they're that type of names. They're solid, good quality producers, which, by the way, have very little fiscal risk right now. They're value assets that are trading at what, 8x earnings? It's nothing, and their free cash flow continues to grow. So they're very good quality companies. But then we have a client, you know, an older client that has a dividend. Requires dividend income. Well, the first thing is that they're very happy right now, because anybody that started last year, that 30% has now become almost 45% of the portfolio. Mm-hmm. And they're very happy. They get it. They want to continue writing up. The first thing we did is trim back to the 30% cutback. And we just finished the allocations. We can talk about the process. As we cut back, we freed up all of this money. Well, that money got re allocated immediately to the pipelines, the utilities, all the inflation, the blue chip companies that are going to benefit from the inflation that we're seeing, you know, like Pembina's and those companies.
And just to make that more explicit, you're talking about trimming back, let's say, if your Agnico exceeds 20% of your portfolio value, you're trimming it back to that 20%, taking that profit and putting it back in the allocations that aren't, let's say, necessarily performing like that at this time, right?
Correct. So Agnico itself is one of six within that pool of money. Mm-hmm. So all we did is trim it back to its allocation because one outperformed Agnico. Agnico now is been the mainstay of the mainsail of our ship all along, but now we have others. The Spinnakers are up, and those are our silver companies that are really starting to take off. Now the beauty is that we've just trimmed right back to the initial allocations that they should be at. So call it, if it's 30% divided among six companies, each one will have 5%. But all of a sudden, they become 10% of the one became almost 10% of the portfolio. Well, it got trimmed back to 5%. So we immediately, that process of selling the outperformance is taking away the emotion of the love and hate that people always go through in terms of, oh, this company's NVIDIA. Everybody wants to own NVIDIA, so it's getting richer and richer and richer. But having a process that cuts back. It cuts back on the emotion between fear and greed, because we also bought one that is kind of dragging right now, so that became cheaper, right? So there was one that was purchased as we went through the allocation. But the net result of the allocation is that it allowed us to increase the dividend cash flow. So we walked away with almost 20% greater dividend just by going through the process of reallocating into the blue chip equities that are paying dividend, right? So it's the process of allocation that's important, because it takes away that emotion of, hey, you know, Jamie, I'm loving the precious metals or Sid, that we've done so well. Well, by cutting back, we use a disciplined process of actually retrimming and adding to those cash flow companies. So we've added income now, and as we move forward, we're going to continue to use the same process. And I think that, because I do think that if you look at this cycle, I think this cycle is different, because one of the things that people don't understand is that unlike 2008 to 2011 cycle and everything that we've gone through now, the big difference is that gold is re-entering the monetary system, one thing that I've been predicted all along. And so as it re-enters the monetary system, people better understand that gold is at 4,000. But in order to do what it needs to do, it has to go higher. And let's touch base on that a little bit later, because Zoltan Posner kind of asked this a long time ago, and we'll go back to it. Okay, so that's in the first portfolio, right? The second component of the portfolio is the second basket is the precious, what we call the special opportunities portfolio, which is a portfolio that's 80% invested in precious metals companies, and 20% in others. There's some blockchain in there. There's some other technologies in there. But that portfolio has also grown a lot. Now the main use of that portfolio is for that client that has everything at RBC Dominion, where they will definitely not buy him any gold yet. Maybe at $10,000 gold, they'll figure it out. Who knows? But who says to us, you know what? I get it. You manage my gold portion. We also have some clients with big assets and that 30%. Well, as we've seen it grow, that also is getting trimmed back, because there, one of the issues that we have is we've had two companies that have completely outperformed. I think that outperformance is going to continue. But by trimming back from their 7% where they were, and all of a sudden they're about a 14%, we are immediately reallocating to the other companies in the portfolio that have just begun to move. And those are those junior silvers where the money's just coming in that are going to have even better leverage to the price. But that discipline takes away from the emotion of, you know what, I really like that company. It's beating, it's running away with us. Well, by trimming back, it answers the question is, should we or shouldn't we? The process does the rebalancing. right? And there again, what we've done is re-strengthen our position because each one of the companies within that portfolio, like look at some of the junior silver companies with high levered, higher cost of production with better leverage to the upside in the price of gold. Those have just begun to move and they represent great value. So we are the one way to look at that is that we sold an asset that has silver where it has appreciated on that silver on the ground. Mm-hmm. And then reshifted over to other silver companies by buying that silver on the ground at a cheaper price, but with better leverage on the way back up. And again, having a process that gives you some discipline that you can trim back. Then we have another basket, which is for accredited investors, where we're participating in the exploration company. That's where really has been the true profits within the practice, because we've had, you know, Newfoundland Gold has finally gone out, but we participated in Newfoundland Gold pre-IPO. Every year we have participated in, like, we're right now riding the top performer this year's a silver company in Argentina, or one of the top performers, Explorer, and they continue to gather. Well, we were able to just trim back that position by 10%. We made a lot of money, but what did we do? We've redirected those assets we've purchased three new plays where we bought resources on the ground at ridiculous prices. Mm-hmm. So I look at and also in the US where I want to be. So one is in Montana, copper gold play. We added an offtake that's coming out of another copper gold play. So we've added actually copper gold because I want to also add some copper. We have a big play in Chile that's done extremely well that we also bought pre-IPO. So by trimming back on those, what we're doing is buying new assets that also have very cheap reserves on the ground. Now, those eventually will run out. So I'm very happy when I find them. You know, the latest one that we bought was a copper gold play coming in Montana, coming out of Rio Tinto. And Rio Tinto is still going to hold a percentage of it. Well, why? Because they've already uncovered on the reserves on the ground, but they never kept drilling lower. So it's a high probability play in that, yeah, we are facing some exploration risk, but we're buying it so cheap that it makes a lot of sense. And the last thing we just bought was a flow-through play. Flow-through for Canadian clients is important because that's the only true exploration. The government of Canada allows mining companies to write off their exploration expenses and pass them through to shareholders,
yeah.
Right? So it works similar to an RSP contribution or an IRA contribution, as they call them in the US, but it allows us to participate in some exploration plays. Every year I buy some of the flow through that comes out of first mining. That one I don't mind talking about because they're building a mine. They have to drain the lake. Well, I'm getting a tax break to sit in a company that is exactly like Detour Lake before they drained the lake. Like, I've been around enough that I participated in Detour Lake. Then it got taken out by Kirkland Lake. And then Agnico got taken out by, regardless, I ended up with both under the Agnico brand, right? Whichever way it went. But again, it requires discipline and it also requires knowledge of the sector. But what we're trying to do is not necessarily, if it's a very conservative client, there we're taking monies out, but we're redirecting it to income within those that are within that have a lot of producers. My strategy is don't fall in love with any one of them. They're all beautiful. Cut back and buy back into the ones that have the same characteristic. And by the way, the characteristics continue to be reserves on the ground, cost of production, good management, and geopolitical risk. So we can switch that and then have the tactical allocations. And then on the exploration front, well, that's where it's a lot of fun. Right now, we're reviewing a silver restart in Peru of a mine that was shut down a couple of years ago. So those keep coming out. And as I find them, we review them and reallocate monies. But now we're working from a position of strength. What's important, though, for the average investor, and I got to cut back, is I don't care about the price. I care about having my allocation. And that's the problem that I see with all this noise about price. If you're worried about price without worrying about putting your seat on the lifeboat of the Titanic, you're in trouble. Because it's not about the price. It's not about the cost of insurance. Because this is monetary insurance is what we're buying, right? If you're worried about the cost of insurance, well, guess what? It continues to get more expensive. When we were first talking, it was at $1,300. Here we are sitting over $4,000. At what point is the light going to come on that maybe gold is signaling something, right?
So, I mean, when, again, being able to zoom out, I think is very useful here. So you have your allocation in this sector, right? And again, when we think about the entire, you know, investing complex as a whole, looking at this chart that you sent me as well, gold and precious metals accounts for 2% of all of you know, everything that's invested at this point. So
you know what, that is a beautiful thing, because that's why we've been able to buy these companies so cheaply. These exactly, people still think it's a pet rock. Mm-hmm. It's remember back when I was telling you about the generational shift, that the biggest problem today is that money managers have a generational short circuit when it comes to gold. Now, the benefit that I carry is that I was taught the bond business in the late 80s, early 90s by the last generation of bond traders who have worked on a bond desk, who have worked under a monetary system backed by gold, sound money system. So gold was traded on the bond desk. This new generation of money managers, well, they've never even known what gold was apart from some jewelry, some piece of jewelry. They don't understand it within money. And as Ray Dalio pointed out to those that were complaining because he had his clients at 30% gold a couple of years ago, if you don't know history and economics, you don't own gold. But listen, if you don't own history and economics, you shouldn't be managing money right now, because the biggest issue that we're living through, and we are living in interesting times, is that we are going through a monetary shift away from the US dollar. And you know what? A couple of years ago, I would have said that and people would say, what the hell are you talking about? If you don't see it now, then you shouldn't be managing money, because that is the biggest risk. These governments will never pay back the trillions and trillions of dollars. Second point. If you're a money manager and you don't understand what a trillion is, when we talk about astronomy, we never talk about trillions. There's billions of stars, not trillions of stars. Mm-hmm. So think about that for a second. And we're sitting with deficits of 30 trillion. That is amazing. Like, so to me, that is a massive benefit, because a more important chart actually is the other one that I sent you with regards to central banks. So let's start at the big boys. Who's buying this? Who's buying gold here? Why is this chart so important? Because that inflection point that we're looking at there is that central banks, as of this year, now own more physical gold than they owe U.S. treasuries. Why is that important? Because it's the U.S. dollar. Let's not forget that the reason why most central banks own U.S. treasuries was because of the deal that Henry Kissinger does in 75, the petrodollar. They needed to hold U.S. treasuries to pay for the biggest expense, which was energy. Well, that inflection point has now clicked. Now, why is that important? Because central banks own more gold than U.S. treasuries. But I bet you that Canadian pension plans own way more treasuries than they own gold. So mm-hmm. they haven't caught on yet. This trend will not end, because what this is signaling is the fact that money is changing and is going back to sound money. Because they trust gold more. The world is trusting gold more than they trust U.S. treasuries. And if you don't think that's true, well, you better question if the world is trusting Mr. Trump, President Trump, in his policies of tariff and how and what he's doing. That trend will only continue. Well, pension plans better get on side. Everybody's retirement assets, family offices, they haven't woken up yet to this shift that is occurring. So when we go back to the other chart, the 2% ownership in the sector, that is great to me, because I'm one of the 1% that have been building these assets. Another thing that's very important, I just came back from Bear Creek and I was sitting with the 1%. I was chatting with Tavik Costa. I was chatting with Ronnie Stoffel. I was chatting with the other managers that understand the sector, own it. And I can assure you one thing, we're not selling. We're not selling anytime soon because we understand where we're going. And we're going much higher because the problem is that that inflection point has occurred. And then we've got to start analyzing, well, if gold is reentering the monetary system, how high are we going? Right. And there again, I think we can probably talk about the work that Zoltan Plaster, who used to be the chief equity strategist for Credit Suisse before they went bankrupt, and he did an amazing analysis. And this was before the BRICS were the big group that they are now. He was just looking at the BRICS themselves, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, just the five of them. And he said, okay, if these countries decide to start using gold to trade oil instead of the petrodollar, that inflection point of US treasuries, right? What price should gold be? What is he asking? What he's asking is, these countries have a constant trade in oil on an annual basis. Well, that number we know. That number is paid for in US dollars. Well, if they were to trade in gold, what would be the same equivalent number? So what he's asking is, if we look at the reserves that those countries share among themselves, what price should those ounces be to trade energy? His number was $7,000. Now, that didn't include gas or anything else, just oil. So that starts to give you some of the numbers that we need for gold to return to do what it has done for 4,000 years. Another data point that gives us a pretty good window of where we're going was Judy Shelton's proposal of the U.S. issuing a 50-year bond backed by the U.S.'s gold reserves. First of all, what she's talking about is rebalancing the asset side of the ledger, which is exactly what Scott Bessent, the new Treasury Secretary, said the first week that he got nominated to the Treasury, we're going to revalue the asset side of the ledger. Mm-hmm. So if you're not listening, you're going to pass out because this train's already moving. Well, but let's talk about this. For the 8,900 tons to be worth $50 trillion over 5 years for that bond, over 50 years for that bond, each ounce has to be worth over $20,000. Mm-hmm. So here we have ranges from 7 to 20. That's why I've always said we need another zero behind gold to get to even begin to function as money. Mm-hmm. If you think that process is not ongoing, well, look again, because one of the problems we have, or benefits to those that are already invested, is the fact that gold in Canadian dollars is at almost 5,700, if I recall, I can remember, in Japanese yen, and it's running in every currency. Because people better understand that that currency you own is backed by your politician and the word of a politician and central banker, right? And that money, how are they going to back it, right? There it is, right? So what we're witnessing is a decline of the fiat system. Sound money.
We have the chart up from, let's say, 2006 to current in six different currencies, and it's just, you know, up and to the right.
Exactly. So this is happening global, right? And the thing is that people are asking, well, it's going to correct. Yeah, you know what? It might correct a little bit, but it's going to be shallow. It's going to be shallow because only 2% of family offices around the world own any gold. And the other problem is we have some physical issues. So let's look at Morgan Stanley for a second, because here's another very important. Morgan Stanley, Mr. JP Morgan, the House of Morgan, just said we should move over from a 60-40 model, something that we've talked about before. The current generalist money managing model is to park money in a 60% in equities, 40% in fixed income. Well, JP Morgan just said the CIO favors moving to a 60-20-20 asset allocation, which, by the way, is exactly, actually, it would have been 50-20-30 at the height of the 70s, 80s inflation crisis that they were at. But the 60-20-20 model, okay, let's review that for a second. These people have almost $1.6 trillion under assets under management. So to get to 20%, allocation in physical gold, guess what? That gold isn't there. There's no way. And this is just one institution, you know, and it's not, I find it ironic that the first one to jump on board, because JPM himself said gold is money. Everything else is credit. what they're saying is the credit cycle is over. You better jump over to real money at 20%. Well, what happens when every institution starts to do this? We're going to run out of gold. Well, to me, that's amazing because it means that my reserves on the ground are going to be worth a lot more money. And the reserves on the ground in a company like Agnico Eagle with millions of ounces on the ground are currently still cheap, right? Never mind the fact that the company's earnings above 4,000, and we're into Q3 now starting at 4,000, are going to be tracking, I calculated using some AI tools. I don't even use analysts anymore, which is great. One of the beauties of AI. just extrapolating one quarter over another quarter, we're looking at free cash flow margins over 60% coming in now, right? That beats NVIDIA out of the water. Tracking their highest was just below 47%. Well, so that's why
I find there's
so much room to go.
I find it interesting, you know, Don Durrett had posted that tweet about somebody saying, analyzing a company based on PE multiples and saying, oh, these companies are expensive. But as you pointed out, if you analyze them, and Don said this, as you analyze them by free cash flow, they're still very cheap, right? So this is just changing the way that we're looking at this sector at the moment because of the time that we're in, right? This shift in momentum. And I mean, again, we have another chart up of looking at gold miners to gold ratio, and it's just broken out finally. And
it's just beginning.
Exactly. Like these are all very bullish signs that we are still at the beginning of the gold miners getting capital coming into that sector.
And never mind the silvers, which are going to be even mm-hmm. more exponential move, right? Because silver, the catch-up, one of the most, the real trait here, which is the one that I keep talking about, why silver will be the goat, is because the gold-silver ratio has finally corrected. So what do we have here? We have gold sitting at 4,000. We have silver finally catching up its bid and running up. And that's going to run out faster than gold, by the way, because of we have a structural deficit. That means, what do I mean by a structural deficit over the last 6 years? Current production is only 900 million ounces, but demand is for 1.2 billion ounces a year. Mm-hmm. Well, isn't it funny that the price hadn't appreciated? Now that those are important numbers because the gold-silver ratio has always been set by the production of gold versus silver. So if we're using production numbers from last year, where we produced 136 million ounces of gold versus 900 million ounces, that's a 7-to-1 ratio. Well, I was adding my companies at 100-to-1 because nobody understands the mechanics of these pet rocks, right? So what we're seeing now is the catch up. So while gold is running, now silver's catching up, and here we are at $50 today. We crossed 50. I think we're pulling back right now because, hey, the Fed is having a presentation, so we got to kill the price of gold. And it's funny because when you were watching those charts way back when, I was trying to remember, was that a Fed week? Because I think it would have been around that period.
Well, it's also, that was peak, start of COVID lockdown. That was literally the pullback that we got in March of 2020. And again, consequently, being able to look back and realize that was actually the week that we were speaking is pretty mind blowing.
Yeah. But again, even back then, I never worried about the price. I only worried about my allocation and to continue to do my monthly silver squeeze. Right. So what do we have? What's the setup today? So gold's at 4,000 and it's running because it's returning to the monetary system. Silver's finally starting to catch up and it has a lot more to go, which, by the way, my targets to when I take profits on my silver companies, and I'm not talking about the asset allocation and all that. When I finally realize, okay, let's have a party and take some money out of the sector, yep, is at a 40-to-1 at least gold silver ratio. Mm-hmm. We haven't even crossed 80 because the other problem that we have is gold runs up and then silver catches up. So at what point? But it's catching up at a greater percentage move than gold, which is what I was expecting when the bull market finally start. And the producers are the ones that are actually winning this race right now. So the producers are also taking in a lot of money because nobody owns them, right? So we have a massive, I love Martin Armstrong and and Michael Oliver, because they're one of the few that always look at the flow of funds in the market. This business has always been about where the money's going, right? And it's been so anemic in the sector where nobody owns them, but everybody's going to have to own them when they start to see the free cash flow that these companies are pumping out at these levels. Now, another important inflection point. So when Agnico flipped around $70, it was free cash flow kicked in at about 17%. First Majestic, which is in my opinion, the Agnico of silver, and it's just starting to take out. Its inflection point was at a free cash flow margin of about, I think it was 26% free cash flow margin. Mm-hmm. So already greater than Agnico had, right? But now with the price of silver running up, that free cash flow is going to kick in at an even faster pace. So I'm not getting caught up. I'm just choosing my sales as I build my portfolio, but I'm letting them run with the wind. And what I'm doing is just trimming them back when the time is correct. When am I going to take money out is at least a 40-to-1 inflection point. Now, the other thing that people have to understand, everybody's saying, oh, we're at top, how high could gold go? Well, if we are into a monetary shift, it's similar to what happened in 1933, what happened in the 1980s, where gold is returning to the monetary system, people better understand that we are heading into a period where gold will reach a level from which it will never come back because it's going to be money again within the global monetary system. Mm-hmm. If that is the case, I want to ride that wave, right? So right now I'm nowhere near getting out. I'm just enjoying the trip as we go. But all I can say to investors, those that are in, worry more about your allocation and trimming back and holding fast to your positions because it is going to get volatile. And in the volatility as well, I think it's gonna forget about the percentage. People are going to be looking at the fact that, hey, at $4,000 gold, $1,000 pullback, nominally $100 is a lot of money, but percentage wise is not that much, mm-hmm. right? So you also have to be smart as to how you manage through. But I can tell you that right now, this feels better than the beginning of 2009 when we started finally taking off, you know, coming into 2010. Mm-hmm. And then we went another year and a half of upside. I think that within the next year and a half, we are going to figure out that, hey, maybe this is different this time and we are into a new monetary system. And that means that gold, that 4,000 that we are now, we will never see again. Mm-hmm. Because for gold to function as money, my personal target is north of 10,000 and I'm being very conservative with that. I'm not going to go there. But I can tell you that personally, I'm planning for another zero behind it. And this is the wealth transfer. This is the wealth shift that always occurs when power changes. Because what's the number one rule of power? He who has the gold, China, makes the rules. And mm-hmm. they definitely have more than the U.S. We don't even know if the U.S. has any gold. Where's that audit that they promised us? Well, I'm beginning to think that maybe they don't have it because now they're pushing this Bitcoin thing and all that. I like Bitcoin. I like blockchain. Don't get me wrong. I like the technology as a ledger, because it replaces the banking system. But if they don't have the gold, they're in trouble, right? Mm-hmm. And they're going to have to start producing everything. But if they do, they're second place in this game, right? But bottom line, we're going much higher for now, at least, right? And how it all plays out, we'll have to wait and see. But gold, if you don't think that gold is money by now, well, you know what? You better pick up a couple of history books very quickly.
Mm-hmm. To your point, Jaime, I pulled up the gold to silver ratio. Of course, we reached almost 120 in 2020, and we're down now to about 80.
Below 80.
So this is, you know, we still have to double or let's say half, whatever, however you want to think about it, the gold to silver ratio in order to get to that 40-to-1 target that you have. Of taking some of your silver miners off the table. But Jaime, you know, thinking back, you know, through history, we've had an 8-to-1 gold to silver ratio, even let's be conservative and say a 10-to-1 gold to silver ratio. Do you think that that kind of target has changed significantly because of the far larger industrial demand now than monetary demand for silver?
You know what? While silver stays below $100 an ounce, smart people like me will continue to buy it, keep it at home to function as that coin that I grew up with, right? Because there's going to come a point where silver itself is, think about going to Costco, the average Costco buyer, you know, they've just finally spent the weekend studying and they realize, oh, you know what, I got to get some physical. They get to Costco and here they are, $5,700 for one little coin of gold versus $70 for one little coin of silver. Mm-hmm. Well, you're going to go for the silver because you can buy way more than the $5,700, right? So that's the beauty of silver. Yes, it has the manufacturing capabilities of it, which are becoming very important because now Samsung's battery is out and we know that it's going to be transformative. The silver usage is just going to start to get bigger and bigger, but the demand for it as a monetary metal, when people are just finally waking up to the fact that maybe I should get some physical out of the banking system and have it at home or have it in a vault or have it somewhere, well, silver demand is only going to escalate from here because now we're in the storm, right? Now that people are getting wet, maybe they're noticing that they have to do something. And I'm seeing the questions. Like I was at a party on the weekend and one of my friend's wives actually got talking about the market and concern. I said, well, have you thought of gold and silver? She's like, well, I hear some noise, but why? Right. So just the fact that she was hearing noises and, you know, 2 years ago, I wouldn't even gone there, but she brought it up. So I find that interesting that people are recognizing that something's happening. They don't really fully see, you know, the Bank of Canada has stopped. They're going to stop the counting inflation here. Mm-hmm. Right. Why? Because the Canadian dollar at 5,700, well, you don't have to count inflation. You just have to look at the price of gold in Canadian dollars to get a real peg of what we were. Don't forget that a couple of years ago, gold and when we were chatting back to your chart, 1,300, the Canadian dollar was almost at par with the US dollar. So in Canadian dollars, gold would have been at 1,300. Well, now gold is over 5,000 and 4,000. So 5,700 in Canadian dollars versus 4,000 in US dollars. That shows you how the US dollar the Canadian dollar, they're both losing value, but the Canadian dollar is losing value at a faster pace. Now, my understanding of that process is to think about it that the monetary Titanic is sinking. As soon as we went over 2,000, we went underwater. Well, even though it's underwater, the US dollar is still on the first deck of the Titanic, but the Canadian dollar is in a lower deck in the Titanic. But we're going under and we're getting overwhelmed by all that credit that's coming in. Mm-hmm. At least I'm secure. My clients are safe. And, you know, I've been consistent with my strategy. I've been consistent with my call that these are unprecedented times and we have to start thinking out of the box. Well, I know that advisors aren't yet. I know that advisors, you know, are still sticking to that 60-40 model. I hope that at least investors are starting to question what the hell's going on and maybe take some action, because I think it's the time for pondering the situation is over. I think it's a time for action. Mm-hmm. I love that headline.
Yeah. So again, kind of getting this perspective, we have a Wall Street Journal article from 2022 that says gold loses status as haven, like I'm guessing safe haven, and gold was at $1,600 an ounce, and that perfectly marked the bottom of 2022.
It kind of goes to show two things: how contrarian thinking. Remember, Warren Buffett lost it on Fortune magazine in the early 90s. And by the way, in 1998, 1999, I was adding brand as a value proposition to my clients' growth portfolios. Mm-hmm. And Warren Buffett was in the front of Fortune magazine because he didn't want to buy Microsoft. Oh, he doesn't get it. He'll never make any money. Now he's God, right? Well, here we go. First of all, what did the guys at Gordon always say? You can't buy news for a quarter. So forget about reading the paper, Carrasco. Information is better sought elsewhere. Kind of Martin Gecko said the same thing in Wall Street. But that goes to show that You know, I think people better start thinking out of their own. And you know, the only concerning thing right now is that Jim Cramer came out and said that.
I saw that yesterday. He's always been a gold bug. And this is, you know, that's another ominous sign of a top.
Yeah. Thank God he hasn't mentioned silver, so I'm safe. Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, going back to this idea of talking about central banks, you recently tweeted that Canada and Chile are, you know, maybe they can be markers of kind of a top when they decide that they need gold again. Is that a fair characterization of how you're thinking about if those countries decide that they need to get some gold again?
Let's not talk about a top yet. Let's talk about a bottom, because funny you mentioned that, because, you know, the week that I was at Bear Creek, there were
three. Error Beaver Creek, isn't it?
Beaver Creek. There were three very important news bits that I thought, okay, if there's ever signals for a bottom of mining in Canada, these are it. Teck bought out by BHP. Barrick, a company that I managed money for years ago, and the leader in mining left Canada. The Hemlo mine, it's split out, so they don't have assets in Canada. And Newmont leaving the TSX. I thought, if I've ever heard three big headlines for a bottom of a cycle, that's it. People, you know, I don't think they fully understand how wonderful the mining business has been for the world, the Canadian mining business, and how the Toronto Stock Exchange over my career has been the foundation of global mining. Well, those three news announcements I thought were very important because they mark more of a bottom in this sector, right? So to me, that's a very bullish signal that I am on the right track. Another important thing, actually, I'm loving watching the new generation of managers coming into the fore, because Jason Kosek took over Hemlo and had participating. He was also the CEO of Millennium Precious Metals, a company that we funded a couple of years ago. So it was beautiful to see that there's also a new generation of management coming online that have done great work that are taking over these companies. So the progression is here, right? Where you have a lot of new blood coming in, right? The Montana play, one of the things that was very impressive is the geological team. Young people, but they're asking the right question. And with new technology, by the way. So mining has completely evolved. But I think Canada will once again be part of that mining equation, because the savoir-faire of the industry is still here. You know, the mining, and I think that's important. And I think those were more signals of a bottom. As for central banks coming on board, the one thing I got to tell you is this, is that we don't need a central bank in a sound money system. Right. So, yeah, they might decide that finally start acquiring. But if we go back to a hard money system, and if President Trump and Bessent and the Chinese actually do go back to a sound money system, what they need is a treasury. They don't need a central bank, because we won't be printing money. Mm-hmm. We're going to reset the system, and we won't be printing money again, I don't think, until we forget the bad side effects of credit, which people haven't fully yet comprehended. They realize that their money's buying less and less and less every day. Mm-hmm. They haven't figured out why, that maybe all of this stimulus, all of these taxes, how we're paying for Ukraine, for all these things that they're promising, you know, they're just printing money. The money isn't there. Europe is imploding politically, economically. Well, yeah, they need a war with Russia to keep it going, you know, but where's the money going to come from? You know, you can print money, but you can't print resources, right? So that interconnectivity is the problem. So I personally think that, and why Chile? Because when I was a director with Scotiabank, I actually sat down with the Chilean Central Bank, trying to get them. At the time, Scotiabank was a bullion bank, and I said, hey, we're a bullion bank. If you guys want to start looking at acquiring gold, so we sat down, we had a meeting, and they said, no, we're never going to look at it. We don't need it. It's a pet rock, right? So that's why I said Chile. I think it'll be the question is which one of those two will be the first one to jump on board. But either one of those to me is because they're also the two that fully sold everything, right? Both banks don't own any gold.
Jaime, I want to go back to something you were saying about the TSX and the value of the Canadian mining sector within the world, right? I've had a lot of people tell me that there's, you know, problems within the TSX with the ability of shorts to come in, the ability of firms to hold and short some of these stocks. Do you see that as a, you know, kind of a double-edged sword where there are some positives to the way that the TSX allows positions to be taken, or, you know, should there be some reform within the TSX?
Now, that's a hard question because now you're putting me between you and the regulators. I think one of the biggest problems today is the lack of regulation, the lack of regulation of short positions, the lack of regulation of position limits, right? So, but that also creates a benefit in that it creates a benefit in that it's why one of the reasons why the price of silver hasn't increased. It's allowed me to build beautiful positions in a very strong way at very cheap prices, mm-hmm. right? How it corrects, the process of correction from a historical basis always takes place, right? So if you look at history, how things rebuild, we always know that we rebuild it better. So we have to let it play out. There's this book going around, The Great Taking, and people are getting very concerned. Well, there are things you can do. I don't own futures. None of the positions that we own are built with futures. One of the problems right now, you know, the ETF you own, which is really, which ones are promises by a bank to give you that participation versus which one actually own the shares. Yeah. I own the shares for my clients, right? I'm also not at a bank-owned firm. I'm at a private firm owned by a private equity fund, right? That's one other way to protect yourself.
In the example of the Great Taking, it was the risk on equities that David Webb was actually talking about.
Right, but the risk on equities. Yeah, but again, if your equities aren't borrowed, if they're segregated, right? So there's ways to setting up your situation. At the end of the day, you know, and one of the problems that one of the issues with the banking business is those changes that the bail-in provision changes that they did in November of 2015, mm-hmm. where now you're not a lender to the bank. When you have your money with the bank, you're an owner of the bank. So if the bank goes under, you're going to be the last guy to get any money. Mm-hmm. Again, those are things that I'm very aware of, and I've set up my clients. You can only protect so much, mm-hmm. right? The other risk that everybody talks about is expropriation. Well, you can't expropriate something that nobody owns. I think if the Canadian government starts to appropriate Canadian oil or Canadian mines, you know what? I think the Americans would have a problem with that, right? And you know, with the U.S., with a lot of U.S. ownership of those assets, you know what's going to happen, right? Again, I think that the what history teaches us, looking at the Latin American experience, going through Chile and what happened, the transition, mm-hmm. everything, the pendulum always comes back. It's all about equilibrium. And the noise on this side of the pendulum right now, where everything social, look at the social contract, look at society, look at everything. Now we're swinging back the other way, right? And as we swing back the other way, we go from very liberated to very conservative. Mm-hmm. Right. And so that process always plays out. And in that conservatism, the property rights become strong again. Right. The individual arises. So we're going from a collective thinking to an individual thinking. I think what's more important is to have a solid long term strategy that allows you to benefit over on a long term basis. And disregard all that noise, the book, The Four Turnings, right? Or the Chondriatic periods, right? We are going to go through these periods of upheaval. All I know is that at the end of the day, if you position yourself well, you position yourself with hard assets, you come out ahead, right? Could it get worse in Chile and Argentina and these countries? Well, you know what? Those that have positioned themselves well are still doing well in these countries.
Yeah.
That's all I know. And I've lived, my family has lived through, you know, my father came to Canada when I was 11 mid 70s. So I kind of saved myself from the economic crisis that they went through. We were going through an economic crisis here as well, but not to the extent of what Latin America was going, the 70s and 80s, early 90s, right? But I know that they survived. So to me, to be worried too much about, oh, I'm going to get wet as I sit in the lifeboat. No, I'd rather just get on the lifeboat and worry about my future. So yeah, I will always be an optimist. I will always look at the positive side of the equation as we come out of this. And then there is the legal precedence, you know, that, yeah, this government might expropriate our assets, but I'm sure that the next government or whatever comes after is going to return them to me, right? Whatever happens. So no, I'm not going to get caught up in that full negativity. I'm just going to look at history and position myself in the way that I know has worked in the past. And I think we'll continue working because, hey, it's not different this time. We're just at the end of a credit cycle. And, you know, that's why I always keep posting that chart of gold under the Weimar Republic with the book When Money Dies, because, you know, gold is telling us that we can dismiss the economic consequences of the actions of our those that we have elected, of central banks, but we can't dismiss the consequences of those actions, and that's what gold is signaling, and that's why gold is running away, and that's why the world is saying, you know what, we don't want any more U.S. credit, we don't want any more debt, and we got to change this, right? And it's funny, I actually somebody sent me that same chart, but with the numbers, and we're exactly at April of 1922 right now.
Which is almost the bottom of the chart. Yeah.
Which is right at the start. Correct.
Maybe 15% of the way to the end of the billion paper marks.
Yeah. And then it gets exponential. Well, they didn't believe it.
A trillion paper marks. Yeah.
Right, they didn't believe it at 4,000. At what point do people start believe that? They didn't believe it at 1,000, at 2,000, at 3,000. Here are 4,000. When are they going to believe that these things are going higher? I don't know, but you know what? There's still some cheap opportunities to get involved, to protect yourself. Silver's one of them. The companies is another, and the benefit of the companies is, you know, it's funny. So Agnico is one of our core positions. We have for clients long-term, and everybody that comes into the practice is buying at a 220 because that's core within the portfolio. But anybody that's been with me since we've been talking has an average cost of $70. The dividend now is almost at 4% for those people. Mm-hmm. It's less than 1% for new clients. And that dividend continues to grow. And that's all I care, that will continue to build. Now, if I'm getting in at $220 versus $70, I don't care. Because I know that at $220, that company would, at $3,700, not $4,000, at $3,700 is trading at about less than 10 times earnings, put it at 20 to 30 times earnings. And here we're sitting now with a $300 company, right? And at $4,000 cash flow, free cash flow margins are going to offset NVIDIA. And they're going to continue to run as we travel down this path. So I'm very bullish. I think what's important for investors and those thinking about the sector is what's going to be your strategy, what's going to be your location. Stop worrying about the price. Start at least, anybody that walks in our door will have a 30% allocation. That's the advice, not 20. But right now it's zero. Most people have zero, right? So at what point, and it's getting more and more expensive. So you know, we can help people get invested. We can get them on that trajectory, but nothing's changed. Just the noise levels are getting better. And to me, I'm on the other side of the trade. I'm riding the trade. So the party's getting better. But you know what? The room's still empty. Institutional money hasn't come in yet. Pension plans haven't come in yet. And they're going to have to. Because if history is repeating and it's not different this time, this is the one sector that will outpace in earnings and free cash flow margins, all other sectors, when we go through monetary crisis. And that's why if you look at, there's a chart out there showing ownership by institutions of the sector over the last 100 years during the four periods like this. And it was all above 20%. Well, they're at zero. Just wait till they get to 5%, 6%, 10%, 20%. That's when I'm going to be getting out of the, you know, when that lifeboat gets nice and crowded, and then I'll start considering, but might be holding it longer. So yeah, it's nice to be working at it from a position of strength.
Absolutely. And a position where you, you know, again, have that historical perspective of what has happened and that churn through the market of, you know, really not exciting times. But, you know, this brings up to me a question again of thinking about more of this stuff long term. So when we're holding miners, we're holding all of these equities, we have to sell this to get back into a Canadian
dollar. Not necessarily. So okay. Think about this.
But let me just frame the question, and then we can kind of separate it out after. So that people understand where I'm going with this is like, okay, great. You've had this amazing appreciation in an equity, let's say Agnico or whatever it is. And you have to, you know, let's just say sell it into Canadian dollars. Well, if the dollar is like gets to a point where it's just being hyperinflated at that similar time that you want to get out of the equity, is that a risk that you see having to happen or having to have a mitigating strategy for? Or, you know, how do you think about that, the other side of the coin of getting back into some type of fiat dollar?
Well, bottom line is that if we're going into that hyperinflationary phase, I'm not getting out of my Agnico. I'm waiting, right, until that storm passes. There's a chart that we've talked about in the past, looking at the past. The same event happened in the 80s. The same thing happened in the 30s. Rick Gruhl always talks about how in the 70s, he bought some stocks for 10 cents that turned into multi-baggers going forward. Egon von Greyers put it differently, where he said, you know, $10,000 invested in the early 70s was paying me $10,000 as in dividends by the 1980s, because the dividends had grown so much. So monetary reset, the one that we can definitely look at is 1933, when the power passes to the good as gold dollar, because Roosevelt resets the dollar. Well, if you had Alaska Juno through that period, you wouldn't have sold it until after the Bretton Woods get set up. Because for a period of about 15 years, a $7,000 investment was paying you $7,000 in dividends. Because that asset grew to almost $90,000, and then the dividend just continued going. If we are in that, I'm not selling my Agnico. I'm spending the cash flow in acquiring more pipelines, more utilities. And that's why I think that answer to that question is a lot later. Right now, what's important is to own the assets that are going to survive through these periods and going to deliver cash flow. Because what is really happening in the basement is that the monetary system is rebuilding. And because it's rebuilding around gold again, as it did in the 30s, right, as it temporarily stopped for 54 years with Nixon, right, as it rebuilds, it's the cash flow of the miners that is also generating the cash flow that is rebuilding the system. They go hand in hand. So that dividend will only grow. And then I take that dividend either to live on, right? Another benefit is that if I sell it, I'm going to have a massive capital gain. Well, I might as well wait until the government changes and everything re-changes, but I still getting that dividend income, that dividend cash flow. And so that component is playing out already, and we're seeing it with the dividend growth. When I set up the portfolio, the only dividend was Franco-Nevada. Now I have almost 12% of the portfolio paying dividends, right? So that is happening. That is repeating, right? And so because of that, I think that the sellout strategy is still out to be defined right now. So what you're asking me is, oh, how, what are we going to do once we get saved from, you know, tomorrow morning because somebody's going to come and pick up the lifeboat, right? No, we're still, the ship's still sinking. We're still floating there. And that's a long way to go. Right now, enjoy the ride and hold on to the assets and let it play out. Mm-hmm. We'll figure that out a little bit later, but those dividends are building and history is replaying as we speak.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's not much necessarily to have to discuss it right now. I totally understand.
Yeah. And more importantly, so the thing is that I'm saying is that if history is replaying, we're going through a monetary shift, I could be holding these assets for a good 10 to 15 years before I finally decide to get rid of them, mm-hmm. which is what happened through that period, right? Through the whole 1933, right through to 1949, when Bretton Woods was set up, having held to your home stake mining in Alaska Juneau, you did extremely well. You didn't go anywhere. And you were getting cash flow that was better than anybody else. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I think it's early. Right now, the main thing is have a strategy to get in your monetary insurance to start buying it. But it's a good question. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Jaime, is there anything else you'd like to leave our listeners with before we wrap up here?
No, you know what, Tom? You always ask good questions. You have a good head going. And I think it's important because you have that track record. You've been in this, you've seen it develop, so you get a better understanding of where we're heading, and I think it's also important to allow investors that aren't yet invested a format to gather the information that they need to make decisions going forward, because they better make it for themselves, right? Mm-hmm. It's time to really start thinking about these things on your own.
Absolutely. Anybody that wants more information from Jaime, he's available on X at IJ Carrasco, CARRASCO, as well as LinkedIn, Jaime Carrasco. Jaime, thanks so much for your time today. Always appreciated. Always appreciate the chat and, you know, going on almost 6 years of knowing each other and having these discussions. It's that privilege is never lost on me.
Thank you very much. And likewise, you ask good questions. I really appreciate the interviews and the discussions that we have, because it allows you to really expand on things that need to be discussed.
Absolutely. And if anybody wants to hear more about your story and how your dad came to Canada and that stuff, there's an older episode of Competent Man that you and I did in person in Toronto, where we go through a lot of that stuff too. So look that up. Jaime, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.